uniforms in grade school. Blue pants and white shirts, making us all look like little abstract versions of the Israeli flag. I'm not sure making young Jews so easily identifiable is ever a great idea, but that's what we wore. And because of the Jewish uniforms, or Juniforms, I never really had to think about how I dressed casually. And the few times I had were kind of disastrous. When I was around 8, I was obsessed with Weird Al Yankovic, and I made my mom get me the leather jacket that he's wearing on the cover of Even Worse, which is by default also the jacket Michael Jackson is wearing on Bad. But for the purposes of this story, let's say I idolized Weird Al and not Michael Jackson. Side note, who would have thought that the guy named Weird Al would ultimately become the less controversial figure? Anyway, I remember walking into school, black leather jacket over my blue and white uniform, chrome zippers and buttons shining under the fluorescent lights, everyone looking at me like I was the biggest fucking idiot in the world. I skateboarded, so I thought, in high school, I'll dress like a skater. Also, I was into Nirvana, Green Day, Soundgarden, Marilyn Manson, Korn, and White Zombie, and I'd go downtown and buy band t-shirts every chance I could. I dyed my Jufro bright green, which kind of faded and turned into a pukey yellow color, so I basically made my big entrance into Point Grey looking like a giant fucking clown. High school meant freedom. We could essentially leave campus whenever we wanted. There was no real security at all, and various kids had free periods throughout the day, so the result was a constant flow of students in and out of the school, which made it easy to skip class and explore Carisdale. It was like our Middle Earth, a mystical and dangerous world. The 7-Eleven was the main hub of social life. To get there, you had to cross the railroad tracks, which had only a few entrance points because of the thick blackberry bushes that ran alongside them. On the other side of West Boulevard, there was Paul's Boutique, the skate shop, and two video stores, a Blockbuster and Rogers, which was a Canadian chain. Then there was a Subway, where a girl was rumored to have blown six guys in the bathroom. Right up from Subway, on a side street, was a Chinese convenience store where they'd sell cigarettes to kids of any age. You'd cross back over the train tracks to get to McDonald's, then heading back to the school, you'd pass an ice rink, which connected to the back of the school. My main priority was not getting killed, followed by making friends and having fun. I asked my karate teacher what the best way to deal with high school fights was.
Don't get in any. There's almost never a fight you can't avoid if you're smart. But if you do find yourself in a confrontation, just knee them in the balls, then smash your forehead into their nose as hard as you can.
The two places violence would mostly break out were behind 7-Eleven and at house parties, which you'd think would mean I'd just avoid those things, but I did not. In fact, they were probably the two destinations I was aiming for the most. Behind 7-Eleven, because I could smoke weed there, and house parties, because I could get drunk there. After school, everyone would go to 7-Eleven and hang out on the loading dock behind it. It's where everything happened. Fights, drug deals, kisses, thefts, treaties. It was an intimidating and exhilarating place to be. I didn't even have the nerve to go there for the first few weeks of high school. And the first time I did go, someone stole my hat. It was like the scary bar in Western movies. No matter how terrifying it was, people still always hung out there. I used to watch Westerns and be like, why are people at this bar? You know there's going to be a shootout. Go hang out somewhere else. But like the bars in those movies, there was no other option. So you had to hang out there. Those cowboys just wanted to see their other cowboy friends and maybe get one of those drinks that made the bar sizzle when the cup overflowed. Sure, they knew there was a chance they'd get shot and fall off a balcony onto a table, but it was worth it. That's how it was behind 7-Eleven. You wanted to smoke a bowl before lunch, and you prayed you didn't get hit by some errant fist as you did. We would also shoplift a lot, which might be an inherited trait. Once I faked a seizure on the floor, distracting the staff, allowing around 70 kids to fill their pockets with everything they could grab before the manager realized I was fucking with him. That got me banned for a week, which in retrospect was a pretty light punishment. I don't drink now, but from when I was around 13 to 23, I would drink as often as I could without derailing my life in a meaningful way. And even though parties were dangerous, they were the best place to actually ingest your alcohol with shelter from the elements. It wasn't that hard to get alcohol, but we had to get creative. We'd get a boot, which is when you ask someone outside the liquor store to buy it for you, or we'd ask an older sibling or cousin or something, which worked fairly reliably. You could raid your parents' liquor cabinet and make a shit mix of little bits of booze from each bottle, which works when you're younger, but once you're drinking significant amounts, it doesn't really do the trick. Or you could steal a whole bottle. But that is Dancing with the Devil in the Pale Moonlight, which is a quote from Tim Burton's Batman. There was a liquor delivery service, Dial-A-Bottle, but you needed a house without parents to receive the goods, which wasn't always available, and you didn't want to order to the party itself because they would take hours sometimes. At some point, we noticed that a lot of bars stored kegs of beer on the loading dock in the back, so one day we hatched a plan to steal one. We grabbed it, rolling it away under the cover of night. Then we realized we didn't have a pump, so we used a hammer and a screwdriver to knock the little pressure ball out of the top. We couldn't keep the keg in any of our homes because it was just too big to hide, so we poured the beer into as many containers as we could find. Tupperware, old yogurt containers, detergent bottles, 2-liter soda bottles, empty jars, shit like that, and we kept the beer unrefrigerated in our bedrooms as we drank it over the next few weeks. We loved to play Edward 40 Hands, wherein everyone at a party had to duct tape 40-ounce bottles of beer to each hand and not remove them until they were empty. We would do the Sentry, where everyone took one shot of beer a minute for 100 minutes in a row, which equals about 8 beers in an hour and 40 minutes. Either way, there were too many fucked up kids in one place, and shit got real crazy quite regularly. At one party, some kids stole the entire washer and dryer from a house. They had a dolly and everything, so it seemed weirdly premeditated. I have no idea why they did it or what they ended up doing with them, but I sure as hell wasn't going to stop them. They couldn't have needed the appliances for themselves. They were high school kids. Even if their parents needed a new washer and dryer, it's hard to imagine they'd be psyched if a set showed up late one night after their son returned from a house party. Cocaine wasn't a very big part of our scene, but at one party over winter break, we got a bunch. I'd never done it before, and I didn't love it, thank God. Things got super out of control, as they tend to when a bunch of people are coked up, and the cops came. I was standing on the front porch, watching in horror, as one of the officers walked up to the door.
What's going on in there? Mind if we look around before we send you home?
Glance back over my shoulder to see the kids inside starting to clean up the cokey mess, but it didn't seem like it would happen in time. The cop was walking into the party when suddenly his partner called out from the street.
Hey, you're not gonna believe this? We're fucking stuck.
The other cop stopped. They all looked towards the street where their cruiser was, in fact, stuck in the snow in front of the house. The cop in the car was jamming the gas, spinning the wheels, not moving an inch.
Fuck.
Do we call it in?
No. Absolutely not. We'll never fucking hear the end of this.
The cop looked at me and some other kids standing by the front door, then back at the car.
Tell you what, kids. You help us push our cruiser out of the snow, we won't break up your party. We'll just leave.
I looked at the kids around me.
Fucking deal!
Our young bodies fueled by cocaine. We pushed the cruiser out of the snow, and I watched as it drove off, which is a very Canadian way for that story to have ended. Also, I'll add that cocaine is a fucked up drug, and I don't recommend that people get into it. On top of being terrible for you, it makes you not fun to hang out with for anyone who is not also on cocaine. I've been to so many bachelor parties where the shroom people are constantly coming up with ways to herd all the cocaine people into one little area so they can just bother each other with their dark rants instead of the rest of us. But as far as giant shit shows involving young people getting super duper fucked up, there was no bigger party than Arts County Fair. It was a fundraiser put on by the undergrads at the University of British Columbia and was the biggest student-run event in Canada. It was essentially a giant beer garden in an outdoor field hockey stadium. Although you were supposed to be 19 or older to attend, it was very quickly discovered that the hand stamps they used at the entrance were really easily transferable from one hand to another if you wet them a little bit. And since the only people manning the door were the undergrads themselves, it was basically a complete free-for-all. Pretty much every kid from every high school would skip class, go to Arts County Fair, press their hand against someone's to transfer a stamp, and get shit-faced all day. And we couldn't be more psyched for our first year, 1997. Me, Evan, and Fogel went early in the morning, skipping our first class and taking the bus to UBC. We licked our hands and pressed them against the hands of the first of-age kids we saw, and that was it. The floodgates were open. We were in a giant beer garden, and we fucking went for it. Beer after beer after beer after beer. If you could physically make it up to the counter and show your stamped hand, they would give you a beer. About an hour into the day, I ran into a counselor I had from summer camp who gave me a weed cookie, which I devoured. Around noon, we were all incredibly fucked up, and I lost Fogel and Evan in the crowd. I tripped and stumbled around looking for them for a couple hours, and at around 2 p.m., most of the other kids from our school started to arrive. A huge line formed at the entrance to the beer garden, and that's where I saw Evan, sitting in a chair right outside the front gate. He had been removed from the premises. He was holding his head in his hand, puking all over the place as dozens of kids from our school waited in line, watching and laughing their asses off. It was playing out in slow motion, pointing, hysterics, blech, Evan puking again. This is how he will be remembered throughout the rest of high school, I thought. A puking loser. Already done by the time everyone else showed up. What a bummer for him, and by proxy, me. Then, two paramedics appeared, holding a stretcher and walked toward Evan. This was going from bad to worse. How humiliating. He was literally going to be carried out in front of everyone. But then, right when it seemed like his high school reputation was being publicly burned at the stake, Evan Goldberg flipped the fucking script and did the stuff of legend. He was loaded onto the stretcher in a daze, and as he was being carried away, he snapped out of it, looked around, and screamed,
"No! I need more beer!"
He jumped off the stretcher, shoved aside the paramedic, and ran. Everyone in the huge line cheered as he bolted past them. He grabbed a beer mug from someone's hand and leapt over the barrier leading into the beer garden. Then he disappeared into the crowd, chugging his beer as he went. If they made commemorative stamps for amazing achievements in getting fucked up, Evans Arts County Fair Rally would be one of them. During the first few years of high school, some of the other kids heard I did karate, which had the complete opposite effect that I hoped it would. It kind of made everyone want to fight me. It just seemed unlikely that I was able to defend myself, so the instinct was to test my abilities. It's like when you see a puffer fish at the aquarium. You're like, that goofy fucking thing can really make itself dangerous? That's bullshit. I gotta see that for myself. Your instinct is to agitate it to see if it'll actually do its thing. That was me. I was a pufferfish, goofy looking in the first place, and when trying to defend myself somehow, even goofier looking. My quest to not get my ass kicked out in the wild was probably never put to the test more than in the case of Smokey McPherson. Smokey was not his real name. His real name was Eric, but Eric had an obsession with the movie Friday. It came out in 1995, and if you were a 13-year-old pothead named Seth, you and everyone you knew were pretty fucking into that shit. Friday is about a recently fired dude named Craig, played by Ice Cube, let's not get into him for now, who lives in Compton with his parents. His best friend, Smokey, in a truly amazing performance from Chris Tucker, is a pot dealer who works for a dangerous upper-level dealer, Big Worm. Smokey wants to cheer up Craig, so they smoke all of Smokey's weed, which he is supposed to sell. Big Worm finds out, and the two have till the end of the day to pay him back. It's fantastic, and Pineapple Express wouldn't exist without it. Eric McPherson was so into it, he dressed like Smokey every day, in khakis, a black t-shirt, a gold chain, and a black baseball hat, which was objectively nuts to begin with, but this motherfucker went so far as to ask people to call him Smokey. Giving yourself a nickname is almost always incredibly whack, and nobody called Eric Smokey unless they were making fun of him, which was sad because it all stemmed from the fact that he just desperately wanted to be cool. Out of respect, I'll call him Smokey for the rest of the story. At a party the previous week, Smokey had hooked up with a girl in our grade, Yael, who had an older brother in 12th grade, Harris, who is intent on kicking the living fuck out of Smokey. Smokey was on high alert, and whenever you were with him, you knew you were hanging out with a marked man. So I, for one, tried to avoid him at all costs. One day, me and Fogel had eaten lunch at McDonald's, and were about to head back to school. Smokey was at McDonald's, too, and he saw us heading back.
Hey, I'll walk with you guys.
Me and Fogel knew he was just looking for cover, but it was hard to come up with a reason to say no.
Sure.
We were walking along the railroad tracks when we looked up and saw the worst possible sight. Harris and about five of his friends coming toward us. The blackberry bushes were trapping us, so there was nowhere to go but back the way we came, which would mean turning around and running for about a block and a half, which seemed like a bad idea. I'm not sure why it seemed like a bad idea. It just did. Maybe turning our backs on them seems scarier than knowing where they were. It's like with wild animals, they teach you that turning and running is bad, which I guess I believe to an extent, but eventually there has to be a point when it's better to run. Like in The Revenant, there was a moment when Leo would have for sure been better off if he'd run. How could he not have been? Smokey was rightfully terrified, and so were me and Fogel.
Oh shit, that's Harris. He's Yael's brother. He wants to fucking kill me, man.
Oh, shit is right. They're fucking coming. Fuck. I knew we shouldn't have walked back with you.
Why not?
Because of this exact shit.
Should we run?
No, that'll make it worse. Maybe this is a test, like, to see if you actually are worth beating up or not.
My instinct is that I am.
You never know. Maybe running proves your guilt.
We kept walking toward one another. We were maybe 45 seconds away from contact.
If they want to fight me, will you help me?
No.
Absolutely not.
Why the fuck not?
Fuck you, that's why. Harris is insane.
But we're friends.
Sort of.
Neither of us have, like, ever been to your house before.
Yeah, I've never even met your parents.
You want to come over tonight?
No, too late. We're not that good friends. Not good enough to get fucking killed.
Please?
Okay, we'll try.
Yeah, okay.
Our two groups collided, and they absorbed him like a swarm. Me and Fogel didn't even break stride. We just kept walking, afraid to look back.
We really pussied out of that one.
Sure did.
Smart choice.
I don't regret it one bit.
I finally glance back to see Smokey being flipped onto the hood of a parked car, his feet sticking vertically in the air before slamming down with a crash. We saw him later that day, black eye. Ripped shirt, telling a bunch of kids in the hall how Harris and five of his friends had kicked the shit out of him on the railroad tracks. I was happy for him. For that moment, he was actually the coolest guy in school. Pornographic entertainment. This chapter is about pornography, but at no point will I get into masturbatory details, so you don't have to worry about that shit. Anywho. I think a lot about those little sea turtles that you see on TV. The ones that are born on the beach, instilled with a natural and unwavering instinct to find the ocean. And eventually they do, but they struggle. That's kind of how it was with me and pornography. I wanted to see it. I wanted to enjoy it. Yet, I could not find it. There was no internet, and when we finally got internet, it was really slow and only on the family computer, which was in our living room, so it was hard to access pornographically speaking. But we had Super Channel, which was the Canadian version of HBO, and it played a lot of movies. I noticed that some of those movies had nudity. So, like many 12-year-olds at the time, I got a blank VHS tape and slowly, over the course of a few months, made sort of a sex scene nudity mixtape. It had a scene from the Steven Seagal movie Under Siege where a woman jumps out of a cake topless, a clip from a sex scene in the Jean-Claude Van Damme film Double Impact, the naked woman beating up Gary Busey in Point Break, and an intense sex scene with Lorenzo Lamas from a film called CIA 2 Target Alexa, which he also directed. So good on him, I guess. Around that time, I was skateboarding with my friends one day, and we noticed that the convenience store nearby had a Playboy in the magazine rack. There was only one option, which was to steal that shit. A plan for a heist was hatched. I would purchase a bottle of Jolt Cola, shake it up too much, and open it in the store, making it spray everywhere, creating a diversion. My friend would hide the magazine behind his skateboard and leave while I was wiping up. It worked like a goddamn Ocean's movie, and by that I mean so flawlessly there's no dramatic tension in any way, shape, or form. We ran to a park to look at our loot, a Playboy that featured a 54-year-old Nancy Sinatra, which was surprising. It wasn't bad, per se. It just wasn't really what we were expecting. She was a solid 15 years older than our parents at the time, so I guess it wasn't hitting the notes we'd hoped it would. Also, it was a Playboy, and therefore rather tame. When I was 13, it all came together, which is the grossest way I could have said that. I did a play that was being put on by the Chinese Cultural Center in Vancouver's Chinatown, which in 1995 was a pretty rough neighborhood. I was standing outside waiting for my mom to pick me up on a rainy day when I looked out into the gutter, and there it was. A porno magazine that for some insane reason had been discarded in a pile of wet pages. I looked up the block and saw my mom's SUV turn onto the street. I reached down and grabbed a handful of sopping wet pages and shoved them in my coat pocket as my mom pulled up. I hopped in, feeling like I just found a briefcase full of gold. I hope whoever's that was doesn't come back looking for it, I remember thinking. When we got home, I ran up to my room and carefully tried to salvage the remains of the magazine. It was like the scene in the movie Titanic where Bill Paxton handles Jack's drawing of Rose after fishing it out of the ocean. I used tongs and tweezers to pull the ball of wet pages apart. I laid it all out on my bed to dry. Over the next few hours, the pages cured into sort of a porn jerky. They were brittle like potato chips. You really had to be careful. Not only were they precious, they were delicate, which only added to their overall mystique. To this day, my brain intrinsically links fragile ancient documents with sex. The Indiana Jones franchise is very stimulating to me. Don't even mention the Dead Sea Scrolls. What's odd is I actually have known a lot of people over the years who have found porn on the street, in parks, things like that. I knew a kid in high school who found a garbage bag full of porn on a baseball diamond near his house. Who is doing this? Who is taking huge amounts of porn and dumping it in playgrounds for kids to find? Is this some unspoken paying it forward cycle that has happened for years? Do porn companies do it to get kids hooked? Is Larry Flint just tossing wet Hustler magazines out of his window into gutters as he drives around Canada? Because if he is, that would be some smart shit, because it got a lot of people I know invested. It personally sent me on a long road. Before internet porn became a thing, I basically engaged in trading circles with friends where we would all share whatever porn we had so everyone got more variety. A side effect was that you got a slightly too intimate look at your friend's sexual proclivities and preferences. Also, sometimes you just got some weird-ass shit. Once in early 2002, my friend gave me a DVD titled Cum Dumpsters 2. I'd not seen the first Cum Dumpsters, but felt like I could probably pick up the story. I was a little nervous to watch it, but I figured, what the hell. I'll never forget what happened next. I put the DVD in my compact laptop and waited for the movie to load. The screen went black, and then the image of an American flag waving in the wind slowly faded in. Then, in elegant cursive, appeared the words, "Dedicated to those who lost their lives on September 11th. And then the opening credits for Cum Dumpsters 2 started, which was a startling tonal shift to say the least. I like to imagine they really just wanted to do something in the wake of 9/11, and that was their only outlet. They were like, we can't let people watch Cum Dumpsters 2 without knowing that we, the filmmakers, understand the climate that we're in and that we're sensitive to it. Otherwise, the whole Cum Dumpsters franchise will just seem tasteless. The see your friends taste in porn effect has been multiplied by a billion with things like Pornhub because you can easily see what global proclivities are. And they are fucking weird. A lot of people seem to want to fuck their stepsister. It's insane. It seems to account for the storylines of like 90% of produced porn. Maybe it's because I never had step-siblings, but I just don't get it. If you ever run into me on the street and you have insight into why someone might want to fuck their step-sibling, please, for the love of God, do not talk to me about it. That would be a horrible conversation to have with a stranger. Another thing about porn is that it seems like one of the last bastions of outward racism when it comes to the titles and categorizing of its movies. The use of the word Oriental is still rampant. It's like my grandfather named the clips. I get that fetishes are fetishes, so you gotta get specific, but have some sensitivity. The comments on porn sites are incredible. They're actually nicer than the comments on most corners of the internet. I guess people who are jacking off are generally in a good mood, but the comments are so supportive and complimentary.
What a great dick.
Her butthole is so pretty.
His load is dope and ropey.
It's so nice. I have no judgment of sex workers whatsoever. I honestly couldn't be more grateful for them. And over the years, I've found myself working with them regularly. We don't have a ton of nudity in our films generally, but there is some. And early on, we realized that a lot of quote-unquote mainstream actors are not incredibly psyched about getting naked on camera. It's more just something they're willing to do for a particular role. We found that if we have a role that requires some sort of nudity, we should hire porn actors. The dynamic is completely flipped. They are generally super thrilled to be on the set of a mainstream movie, getting to do something funny, and whatever we're asking them to do is definitely going to be one of the least intrusive things they've been asked to do that week. It's a win-win-win. Over the years, I've had the pleasure of working with Stormy Daniels, Jenna Hayes, Donica Thorne, Bambino, and a lot more. One of the peaks of my porn-related endeavors happened in 2003 when I went to the AVN Awards in Las Vegas, which is like the Oscars of porn, mostly in that it's fucking long as fuck. There were 94 categories, each announced live, and they got very specific. Some were...
Best three-way sex scene. Best all-girl sex scene. Best oral sex scene. Best couple sex scene. Best solo sex scene. Best anal sex scene. Best foot fetish sex scene. Best ethnic themed video. Best non-sex performance. Best specialty big bust video. Best VHS packaging. Best vignette series. Best tease performance. Most outrageous sex scene.
Something called Love in an Abattoir won this, which sounds fucking gross and appears to be misspelled in the actual movie. The show itself lasted about 5.5 hours, and in a lot of ways it was like any other award show, but with a slight porny twist. You know how, like, at the Golden Globes and shit, Halle Berry will make some deep comment and they'll cut to Tom Hanks nodding thoughtfully, which appears on a big screen to the side of the stage. At the Porn Awards, they did a similar thing, but whenever they cut to someone in the audience, that person would see themselves on the screen and pull out their breasts and start licking their own nipple or something like that. It really split focus. Another takeaway was how genuinely moved the winners were. I've been to the Academy Awards a handful of times, and I can say with absolute certainty that these porn performers were more emotional while accepting their awards. They would cry hysterically as they gave their speeches. I can't tell you how deeply moved and touched I am to be given the award for Best Anal Orgy. This just, it just means so much to me. And it should. They really deserve these awards. The winner of Best Anal Orgy worked harder for that statue than Meryl Streep ever has. Sure, she learned to talk like Julia Child, but can she stick 9 dicks in her ass while keeping good light for the cameraman? This is not a rhetorical question. Can she? I've watched a lot of porn on the internet over the years. A point that was really driven home recently. About 5 years ago, my wife and I bought a house in Los Angeles that has a distinct water feature behind it. And a few months ago, I was scrolling through an obscure C-grade porn site when, among the dozens of thumbnails filling the screen, one caught my eye. It appeared to be the water feature from my new backyard. I clicked on the thumbnail, and there it was, our new house with 4 Russians having a very uncircumcised orgy in our water feature. The clip seemed about 10 years old and only had a couple thousand views. I had a lot of thoughts in that moment, but the most prevalent was, I did it. I looked at all the porn there is on the internet. It is the only way to explain the statistical improbability of me finding this clip. The truth is, if you live in a house in Los Angeles, odds are some porn has been shot there. And if you live in a house of any kind, anywhere, somebody has definitely fucked in it. So the presence of cameras doesn't really make a difference on a sanitary level. At least I got to see some of the people who fucked in my house before I lived in it. Odds are you didn't. I consider it a gift. Yearbook. I grew up in a perfect storm type situation when it comes to being someone who developed a love for weed. I'm from Vancouver, which is and always has been one of the most liberal cities in the world when it comes to weed. Also, I loved hip hop music, which aside from a few odd lines here and there, was pretty much telling me to smoke weed all the time. And finally, I was, and still am, a white person. So statistically, my odds for really getting in trouble for using it were, and still are, small. When I was 13, I desperately wanted to try it. The elf folk had tried it with her older brother, and I was jealous.
What does it feel like?
It burns your throat like crazy.
Awesome.
I had a will, but no way. But once I was in high school, the floodgates opened. A few weeks into eighth grade, Steven Glansberg, Josh Korber, and Saul Moskovich came up to me in the hallway.
We got some.
You got some? Some what?
Weed.
Holy shit, it was on.
After school, we're gonna go to the ravine and we're gonna smoke it.
All day I was freaking out with nervous excitement. I really had no idea what to expect other than a burning throat, and that's probably because being stoned from weed is actually really hard to explain. We went to the ravine, which is, well, a ravine, with a walking path running through the bottom and nice houses along the ridge. It's a few blocks from our high school, and it seemed like a good place to smoke in an isolated environment, which is generally the goal. We stopped at 7-Eleven for free Dixie cups of water, which would help combat the inevitable throat burn that we had coming our way. Moskovich got two cups. When we got there, he pulled out a nug of weed in a small Ziploc bag. It had been in his backpack all day, and because it was particularly fresh and sticky, it had been smushed into a flat little pancake about the size of a nickel. My only visual experience with weed up till then had been in movies. Cheech and Chong, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, The Breakfast Club has a weed scene, but I didn't know that until I was around 19 or 20. The copy I had as a kid was taped from TV, and the weed scene had been cut. Not until years later when I saw the unedited version did I understand that they'd smoked weed, which made the ending with them all being friends make much more fucking sense. All this is to say that all the portrayals of weed I'd seen were basically giant bags full of dry oregano, not a tiny bag with a moist little squish nug in it.
What do we do with it?
We smoke it.
He reached into his backpack and produced a 12-inch green plastic bong that he'd bought from a piercing shop downtown. He poured one of his two little water cups into it and pressed the butt into the bowl. After around 30 attempts, we got the lighting sucking timing down, and we'd worn away at the nug enough that it actually started to burn. I got a big, huge, gigantic hit. I felt the weed's fingers start to tickle their way into my brain, and then I exploded in a coughing fit. Here, Glansberg handed me a little water cup. Have some water for your throat burn. I had some. Then Glansberg, Korber, and Moskovich each got one giant rip from the bong before the bowl was cashed. I was high. Very super duper high. I remember thinking time was acting funny. 1 second would take 5 seconds, then 2 seconds, then 5 seconds would go by in 1 second, which was not a normal thing for time to be doing. My vision was processing everything in steps rather than fluid images, as if I were seeing a flipbook of reality. Like I said, I was high, and I was enjoying it. That is, until Moskovich opened his mouth.
All right, now we just gotta go back to school so I can stash this bong in my locker, and we're cool.
What? I can't take it home. Why not?
Because my parents are up my fucking ass ever since I got caught shoplifting that Smashing Pumpkin CD from HMV. They go through my shit all the time. I'm under a fucking microscope, dude. They'll fucking find it.
If you're under a microscope, why'd you buy a foot-long bong?
Because I wanted our first experience to be fucking awesome. Fucking sue me!
Well, we are not going back into the school high with a stinky bong we just smoked out of.
You got any better ideas?
Throw the bong away!
Fuck that! This shit cost $17. I had to bust downtown to get it. Some dude was getting his cheek pierced in front of me while I was paying. It was fucking gross.
Fine. Let's just be fucking cool and quick.
We walked the 3 blocks back to school in a manner that was neither fucking cool nor quick. It was a disaster. I vividly remember Korber, who is now a rabbi, doing the Macarena in the middle of the road as drivers leaned on their horns trying to vacate this stone child from traffic. I stopped them at the border of the school's property.
We are not going in there.
Why not?
We're gonna get fucking expelled.
No, we're not. We're just gonna go in there and put it back in my locker.
What if someone sees us?
They'll assume we're there for some after-school thing.
What if a teacher asks us why we're there?
We'll just say we're there for photography.
What if it's Miss Correa? She teaches photography, dude. Then what?
Then we'll say we're painting sets with stagecraft. Fuck! Chill the fuck out! Don't be a narc!
But don't you dare call me a fucking narc!
Then don't fucking act like one!
I didn't know much, but I knew goddamn fucking well I didn't want to be a narc. I had no idea what a narc was specifically, but it seemed derogatory as a motherfucker for someone who was and is desperately trying to be cool.
Fine, fuck, but be cool and quick. Korber, no Macarenas. Glansberg, don't encourage him.
The hall seemed twice as tall as normal. We floated past the auditorium and rounded the corner toward Moskovich's locker. He opened it, slid open his backpack, and tucked the bong inside the pocket of a snow jacket he had hanging in there. The deed was done. Almost.
What are you guys doing here?
We turned to see Mr. Kefalis, which is Greek for big head, which was hilarious because he had a giant bald head. He was a cool teacher, but he would have expelled our asses in a second for having a freshly used foot-long bong in school, mostly because it would be clear we were indeed too stupid for high school if we were doing shit like that. He was a narc.
Huh?
What are you guys doing here? School ended 45 minutes ago.
We looked at each other. We'd practiced for this. It was time.
Photography.
Where are your cameras?
Holy fuck, this was an intense interrogation. I prayed someone would be able to come up with something.
In the darkroom.
Okay.
It was the perfect heist in a world where the ideal version of a heist was sneaking into school to deposit illegal goods because you had previously been caught stealing a Smashing Pumpkins CD. But either way, we did it. We went to 7-Eleven and got big-ass Slurpees, a tradition that would eventually render me what my doctor calls pre-diabetic. But aren't we all? We wandered around Carisdale, and eventually, I went home. As my mom drove me to karate class that night, the weed was wearing off, and I remember thinking, I would very much like to try that again. And try it again I did. Pretty much every Friday after school, we would scrounge together whatever money we had and buy a gram of weed. During the school year, weed was easy to come by, but during the summer, shit got much trickier. The dealers wouldn't hang out behind 7-Eleven because there was no set time when they knew 100 kids would be there. This was before cell phones, even pagers were kind of an extravagance. But Vancouver always had one reliable way to get weed. Rec Beach. The summer after 8th grade had just begun, and I was in a world of shit already. The last day of school, I had bought 2 ounces of magic mushrooms with the goal of eating them for the first time and selling them to others who would like to eat them for the first time. Don Watkins had an older brother who could get 2 ounces for $100, which I planned to divide up and sell to my friends for $10 an eighth, which would essentially give me a free eighth and $20 for my trouble, which everyone deemed acceptable. We were fucking psyched. During final period, we got our yearbooks, and when the bell rang, everyone rushed into the halls and onto the field to sign each other's shit. Hags, have a good summer, was a popular, if not obligatory one. But if you were friends with people, the notes got more specific. And if you were friends with me, the notes were specifically a bunch of motherfuckers writing about how psyched they were to do the shrooms I just obtained. Also, if you were me, you were not the most proactive thinker, so this wouldn't even bump you as it was happening. I divvied up the shrooms and sold 1 ounce to Josh Korber and 3 other dudes I wasn't good friends with. When I got home, I put the 2nd ounce under my bed, tossed my yearbook on my bed, and took the bus to meet some friends who were smoking weed at one of their grandma's houses while she was on a cruise. She had one of those chairs that ran up the side of the staircase, and we would take turns riding it while we were baked. My parents generally didn't snoop through my shit, and flipping through your son's first high school yearbook honestly doesn't seem like an invasion of privacy. I also totally understand that if you were flipping through that yearbook and saw like a dozen and a half references to the sale and consumption of hallucinogenic mushrooms, you would then search your kid's room. You would also probably be dumbstruck at how easily you found what you were looking for. An ounce of mushroom sitting under the bed. Wow, my son is stupid, you would think, and you would not be wrong. That night I came home and I was in trouble, but not as much as I could have been, due to an odd ally in the form of the Vancouver Police Department. My parents aren't really drug people, and when they found the shrooms, they were shocked by the quantity. It was a completely full Ziploc bag, essentially the size of a small throw pillow, made entirely of fungal hallucinogens. Worried, they called the police to ask about them, because there was no Google, and I guess this was their best option, although it seems like some more narc-ass shit to me. But the police told my parents that mushrooms were particularly abundant this time of year, and that they were wildly inexpensive, even free a lot of the time. This really calmed my parents down. When they sat me down and told me what the cops had said, I jumped all over it.
Yeah, it's not a big deal. They were free. Someone gave them to me. I didn't do them. I just shoved them under the bed.
Who gave them to you? This was one of those quick math situations. Who do I know well enough that he's been around often enough that my parents would know him and would believe he'd gift me a bunch of shrooms, but I also dislike enough that I can never really hang out with him again casually because my parents will fucking hate him from here on out. Oddly, the truth worked.
Don Watkins.
Yeah, I never liked that guy.
Truth be told, I didn't either. He said anti-Semitic things all the time, so fuck him. I still got in trouble. Every time I went out, I had to go with a pocket full of quarters, and I had to call my parents from a payphone every hour on the hour, which is why the thought of going to Wreck Beach to score some weed was scary. It was a 45-minute bus ride, which made my phone calls tricky, and once you got there, it was a walk down a 500-step staircase to the beach, which was inhabited by hippies who had been selling weed there since the late 70s. Also, it's a nude beach. I was terrified.
Have any of you guys been there?
Nope, but who cares?
Saul was basically fearless.
Do we have to get naked?
I don't know. How would they enforce that?
A sign?
I mean, I don't think they can make you get naked.
What if we're seen as like pariahs because we're not naked and nobody wants to sell us weed because we're clothed and we went all the way there for nothing?
I was spinning out.
Who fucking knows, man? All I know is I want to smoke weed all summer, and this is the only way I can think of to get it.
We had pooled around $50. We all had different ways of scrounging cash. In Canada, it was slightly easier because of the $1 and $2 coins, or loonies and toonies, which are not doing Canada any favors when it comes to being taken seriously. Every house has little bowls of change scattered around, but in Canada, those bowls could accumulate a decent amount of money. After a few weeks, you could have $20 in change. I turned to Saul and was like,
yo, in all honesty, would you get naked for the weed?
He thought about it.
Yeah, man, I would. Would you?
Yeah, I think I would.
Cool.
How do you think it works? Do you think they have cubbies or something where we can put our clothes?
I don't know. I imagine they'd have hooks or racks or something.
If we're naked, where do we put the weed once we buy it?
I don't know, man, let's just go.
I called my mom for my hourly check-in, and then we hopped on the bus towards the University of British Columbia, which is right near the beach. We hopped off, I checked in again from a nearby payphone, and we began the trek down the forested stairs toward the ocean. I really hope I don't have to take my pants off and have everyone see my dick and balls and stuff, I remember thinking over and over again. We passed a few hippies walking back up the stairs from the beach. Oh, man, why can't one of those hippies on the stairs sell us weed? That way, there would be no way I'd have to have my penis exposed. We kept marching until we reached the end of the path, which spilled out onto a beautiful beach. And there we were, three tweens in skater shorts and Stussy shirts on a beach with dozens of middle-aged naked people. We stood out like clothed thumbs. Nudists are weird. My friend went to a nudist colony and came back with a newfound appreciation for clothes. One thing he learned at the colony was that you have to carry around a towel to sit on. Why? So you don't get poop from your sweaty butt on things. Well, fuck me. Let's just wear pants. Cool?
Skunk? You want to buy some skunk?
It's not a word we had ever used for weed, but we knew what he meant. We went over to a tall, leathery dude who was completely naked except for a fanny pack, which was covering the top two-thirds of his penis, leaving the other third of penis and his testicles dangling below.
Yeah. Hey, sir. We'd like some skunk. We have $50.
Oh, shit. More than I thought. Okay.
He unzipped his fanny pack and used the lid like a little tabletop, his balls and penis base acting as the legs.
Gonna have to combine bags.
He dumped the contents from a few little baggies into one bigger bag, and I was transfixed by his dexterity on this improvised surface and his overall comfort while being naked. I was jealous. My balls had barely seen actual sunlight. They were generally confined to Costco underwear. His looked like those old-timey brown leather baseballs. They seemed like you could strike a match off of them. If he did shave them, he did it with a straight razor. No cream. This dude's balls had seen things mine could only dream of. Also, I wondered if this was extra illegal because he was naked and we were 14. I could only imagine it wouldn't help his case.
Look good to you?
Yep, it all looks perfect. We'll take it.
As we walked through the endowment lands, the forests surrounding UBC, I had two thoughts. One, that was totally and 100% worth it because this is great skunk. Two, it would be so funny if the nude beach was called the Endowment Lands instead of Wreck Beach. As ninth grade rolled around, we wanted more weed. Like, a lot of it. And by we, I specifically mean me and my friend Brian Baumstick. Me and Baumstick didn't come from families with money as many of our classmates did, and we thought the best way to get some cash was to buy a huge amount of weed at a cheap price, break it up into small portions, and then sell those portions at a profit, aka become drug dealers. We were telling other kids we were in the market for a bunch of weed, and that's when Billy Yang stepped up. His father was a hairdresser from Hong Kong, and his mother was a British flight attendant, and he transferred into our high school. I honestly was not that nice to him, and we didn't get along that well. But when he came to us saying that he knew these dudes from another high school who wanted to unload 60 grams of weed, we were psyched.
60 grams for $300.
What? How?
Yeah, they want to get rid of it.
What school do these guys go to?
Somewhere east.
Where do we meet them?
This weekend, the Crescent.
Perfect.
My parents were out of town, and Danny agreed to drive me and Baumstick to the Crescent, which is one of Vancouver's richest areas. It's a circular park surrounded by a bunch of mansions. Odd place for a drug deal. It made us a bit scared. Baumstick came to my house before we left.
We should bring weapons.
What? I don't know about that.
We totally should. We don't know these guys.
Fine.
I looked around my room and spotted a small souvenir baseball bat that I had gotten from a Seattle Mariners game a few years earlier.
Take this.
Perfect.
Baumstick swung it around. I chose my weapon, a pair of wooden nunchucks my dad had gotten me at a flea market.
I'll use these.
We stuffed our weapons in the kangaroo pouches of our hoodies and hopped in the GMC Jimmy, which is a car that was only sold in Canada. My sister pulled up and the dudes were already there. Three big guys who looked about 18 or 19. When you're 14, that's fucking terrifying. One of them may have had the beginning of a goatee, which might as well have been a bandolier filled with the severed ears of his enemies. We walked up to the guys while my sister idled nearby.
Yo! You the dudes who's gonna buy this shit?
Yeah, we sure are.
You wanna sample it first?
Whoa, curveball. I'd never been asked if I wanted to sample drugs before. It seemed so professional. I remembered watching Bad Lieutenant a few weeks earlier. We heard there was a lot of nudity, so we rented it. There is, in fact, a lot of nudity. Most of that nudity is of Harvey Keitel, who sports one of the greatest bushes in movie history in that film. In it, the Bad Lieutenant is always sampling cocaine, rubbing some on his gums to see if it does whatever cocaine is supposed to do when you rub it on your gums. It all of a sudden made me feel quite cool. Even though, as long as it was, in fact, weed, we were going to buy it no matter what.
Yeah, sure, we'll sample it.
They pulled out a joint, which they lit, and then handed it over to me and Baumstick. None of them smoked it, which at the time didn't seem that odd. It wasn't until I got more high than I'd ever been that it started to maybe add up a bit. Perhaps I thought, this weed is laced with something. Maybe PCP, like in the movie Friday, which was really my only context for this kind of thing. One of the dudes suddenly changed the tone.
Yo, there's too much heat in this park. We should move this somewhere else.
You can just give it to us.
Nah, we'll meet at the school down the road. It's more isolated there.
They picked the fucking park in the first place, but whatever. We were weed blind and too high to be thinking straight.
Okay.
My sister drove us and dropped us off in front of an elementary school.
Come back here, around this corner. Nobody will see.
There was absolutely nobody around in the first place, but again, we weren't thinking straight. And even if we were, who knows if we would have done anything different, because we were, at this point in our lives, quite stupid. They led us around the back of the school to a narrow walkway that dead-ended in some dumpsters. It was indeed very isolated. Then, with a flourish and level of showmanship that I still marvel at to this day, the dudes all reached into a backpack and pulled out gigantic butcher knives. One of them held his up and said proudly,
"You motherfuckers are getting jacked!"
It's cliche to say that things move in slow motion in these situations, but when you may or may not be on PCP and you're in a life-threatening situation, shit gets real slow. Molasses slow. Slow enough to have meaningful and in-depth conversations with yourself about all the terrible choices that led up to this moment and all the terrible choices you could still make while in it. My first thought was, dear God, please don't let Bombstick pull out that little Seattle Mariners baseball bat. I did not want this to devolve into hand-to-hand combat. They had knives. Bombstick had a Ken Griffey Jr. souvenir, and I had nunchucks, which, unfortunately, as a weapon, fucking suck. It all seems so stupid. Why did I even bring these fucking things? They simply didn't work. I tried to flip them around a few times, and every time I ended up whacking the fuck out of myself. Even if I did get into a nunchuck groove, as soon as I hit anything, it would send them bouncing all over and fuck up the nunchuck groove, or again, bounce back and whack me in the face. The next thought I had really made no sense, and my only justification is that PCP makes me rebellious or petulant or something, but I thought, fuck these dudes, I'm not giving them shit. They knew we had around $300 on us, but still, I decided to hold my ground.
Give us your fucking money!
No.
Give it to us now.
No!
Bombstick took the opposite approach and unloaded all his belongings instantly.
Here, take it! Take it all!
My third and final thought, which was also debatable, was we should fucking run. Now, Bombstick was more boxed in than I was, but I guess PCP messes with my spatial awareness because that didn't seem to matter to me. As the dudes were swinging their knives at us, screaming for us to finish unloading our cash, I leaned into Bombstick and said,
"Run on three. One, two, three."
I was 10 feet away before Bombstick even processed what I'd said. Everyone kind of froze, shocked. I stopped in my tracks, looked back at the group.
"Fucking run!"
Bombstick took off behind me and the dudes gave chase. We rounded the corner and sprinted across the front lot of the school. My sister saw us coming and started the jimmy. We hopped in and peeled out, leaving the butcher knife dudes behind us. We lived, and I hadn't lost anything. But Bombstick...